Welcome back to the Tetual Talk. In this engaging episode, HD and Cyber Shorty sit down with Kiera, aka the Data Conversationalist, to peel back the layers on all things tech, data, and AI. From the early days of college struggles and navigating a male-dominated computer science world to carving out a unique space at the intersection of data analytics, Kiera shares her candid journey with listeners. The trio dives deep into real-life job scams, the evolving demands of workplace, and why upskilling, networking, and authentic relationships matter more than ever, especially during a tough job market and mass layoffs. But it's not all about work. The conversation meanders through pop culture, reflections on moving cities, trading stories about community and identity, and even touches on the wild world of all going rogue, with hilarious and sometimes concerning anecdotes about chatbot agents and the future of AI in the enterprise. Whether you're just curious about breaking into data, looking for practical advice on career pivots, or just want some laughs about tech we can't live without, this episode is packed with knowledge bombs, straight talk, and the vibrant chemistry that makes the Tetual Talk your go-to for tech enthusiasts everywhere. Plug in and let's enjoy the episode. Welcome back to the Tetual Talk podcast. I'm your host, HD, and we have none other than with us,
your co-host, Cyber Shorty.
And we have our guest today,
Kiera, aka the Data Conversationalist.
All right, but first and foremost, if you're listening on any type of podcast streaming software, please follow us, leave us a review, and share it out to somebody who may be interested on your drive to work today. And if you're on YouTube, please hit the like button. And the people that's not subscribed, subscribe too. Now, for the people who are members on Patreon, y'all been seeing us talk about a whole bunch of different things, but this is going to be a good one. But for the people who don't know who Kiera, the Data Conversationalist, is, who are you?
Who am I? I am, first, a data and AI strategist. I am a multidisciplinary woman. I'm a mother. I am a content creator. I'm also a career coach. I do it all. I'm every woman. It's all in me. But most importantly, I am just a enjoyer of talking about data and AI. So thanks for having me on the show.
Nah, thank you for coming. I know this has been something we've been trying to get together to do for a while. And it's funny, you like 2 hours down the road.
Yes, literally right up the street in Austin.
How do you like staying in White Atlanta?
White Atlanta is crazy.
It is outrageous.
That's nuts. But it's the truth. I mean, it's cool. So I went to school at UT and then I decided to stay there afterwards just because the tech market is great. Mm-hmm. It's cool. I don't see myself staying there long term. I'm originally from Houston. I actually really, really like the Woodlands area. I think I would love to settle down there. It's such a great area. So inspirational, you know. And then also, probably live in also New York and Miami, too, from time to time.
I could definitely see you in New York.
I love New York.
I could see you in New York, for sure.
I love it there.
See, so. I wouldn't do New York. You know what? If I moved up north, I'll move somewhere that's close enough to New York, but yet I ain't got to pay New York prices. I'd probably move to Connecticut.
That, or either people do Jersey, too.
I'm with Connecticut because it's lower key than New Jersey, too.
And it's close. Like she said, it's nothing but a little
train ride.
Take the train to Grand Central Station. It took about an hour from take the train ride from Stanford to New York. So it wasn't too bad.
But people do that on a day.
Yeah.
To commute to work.
Yeah, I would do that because they got the WWE headquarters out there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I ain't going to lie. It's a straight, because I forget it's a college town. Mm-hmm. But it's a straight little city. I'm always saying something new every time I go out there.
I love that. I might have to take a little trip out there and see what's up.
But, for the people who are familiar with the DFW Metroplex, the Woodlands would be equivalent to Frisco. Mm. So, Frisco, Plano, however you want to call it. Now, you got a lot of experience.
I have a lot. It's a lot.
And I didn't have this question down, but when you went to college at UT, what did you major in?
I majored in computer science, minored in sociology.
I want to touch on the sociology part.
That's a cute combo. What made you choose those two?
I chose computer science because of the money. If I'm being honest here, I was just like, I'm not sure I want to get a master's, but I know whatever I get, I need to have money. So I looked it up and it was like one of the top 5 degrees by the time I was like a senior in high school. So I was like, okay, I'm doing that. I bamboozled myself because it turns out CS wasn't what I thought it was. I thought it was just like clicking and opening applications for old people, kind of like how you used to. Like, I just knew that that's what it was. Like, because you see them in the Apple store, I didn't realize it was coding. So my first day of class and they were talking about for loops, I was like, what are we doing right here? But yeah, I did that. And then I also wanted to minor in sociology just because I really do like arts and you know, English and all that stuff. And studying people and why they are the way they are is really interesting. And I think that's actually one of the core components of why I'm able to excel and really do good in data and AI, DevOps, all the other disciplines I do. But it's really cool. I would like to go back and get a master's in it if I can. I haven't niched down on exactly what I'd research, but I definitely want to do research.
This video will be sponsored by SNHU. So it's 2025 and cybersecurity is still all the rage. Breaches are at an all-time high and so are cyber salaries. But there's a problem you keep running into. Cyber jobs you want to land are requiring a degree and you don't have one. Let me introduce you to today's sponsor, Southern New Hampshire University, SNHU. SNHU has a flexible online program that also touts one of the lowest tuitions in the country. SNHU is an affordable, accredited, nonprofit university that has dedicated career advisors, webinars, internships, and more to prepare you to enter or advance in the workforce. There's a 32% projected growth of information security analyst roles through 2032, and according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median security analyst salary in 2023 was $120,000. In SNHU's program, you can learn about these critical subjects: cybersecurity foundations, networking, incident response, risk management, enterprise security, and more. As a cybersecurity professional, these are all important courses. If you would like to know more about SNHU's program, then please visit snhu.edu/textual or click the link below in the description.
Okay. And before you get to your question, I also want to ask you, what's like a random sociology fact or something that you do when you either encounter people or something that you peep out that everyone probably wouldn't peep out unless they had a background like yours?
Well, the first thing I do is just immediately try to relate to people. I'm not sure if that's even sociology, but a lot of people that just based off of their backgrounds, what are their hobbies and what makes them who they are? Because that way I can relate to them. And because I'm relating to them, it's easier to break things down, especially when we're talking about business. Most people don't understand that while it's a soft skill, those soft skills are usually the hardest to master because it requires a lot of emotional intelligence, because not only are you thinking about your own emotions, you're thinking about other people too.
Shout out to you for bringing up EQ. But I know you're over there itching to ask away.
I was going to ask about the computer science thing.
Yeah.
How far into the degree did you say like, all right, I have this now? Because you said you started out first day of class was, you know, kind of alarming. Mm-hmm. But at what point did you feel like, okay, I'm feeling better. I got this in the bag.
I didn't. If I'm going to be honest, I didn't. It's quite honestly, I also had a lot of health issues with autoimmune disorders going on at the time. I almost didn't go to college. I literally got out the hospital like 2 days before class was supposed to start. Yeah, I got diagnosed with this really rare thing. So I was in like 4 or 5 different hospitals trying to figure it out for like 2 weeks. It was nuts. But anyways, I was like, I'm going to college. I don't care. I have to, you know, figure it out. So, because I was dealing with all of that, dealing with, you know, being in college, away from family and all of that, I almost failed out. Like, so I had to basically, petition to stay in my right before my junior year, because they were about to kick me out. So I basically had to write an essay letting them know, of course, I was having a lot of difficulties with my autoimmune disorder. It's affecting like the way my cognitive thinking is all going and all of that. And they were like, okay, so you have to make at least B's or like a 3.0 or 3.5 GPA for like your next year. If you can do that, you'll stay. And they let me in. The petition process for staying in CS and UT is extremely difficult. I think like maybe even only like 3% of people that petition get to stay in. So I felt extremely lucky. But from there, I doubled down. And I think I also had difficulties because in that first year, like I said, with the for loops, I immediately went to office hours for my teacher or professor at the time to try and get help. And he immediately looked me in my eye and told me I didn't have the logical thinking to survive in CS and I should just drop out. It was literally just that first time. All I did was ask him about for loops. We didn't have a long, in-depth conversation. He didn't even teach me about for loops or say anything about it. That was just off rip. So I don't like when people tell me no. I don't like when people tell me, yeah, like, how are you going to tell me who I am and what I can and can't do? So it was very interesting to see my senior year. We're in the elevator together and he's like, oh, hey. He's like very shocked. And I'm like, hey. And at that point, I was feeling much more confident because I went to school with people who had been, they had to basically create their own app and release it on the Apple Store before they can get an iPhone. Mm. So they had been doing this since they could walk. I had been going to people who had the, or going to school with people who had the directors and VPs of Google and, you know, Microsoft as their parents. So it's a very different world for me because I had a very low socioeconomic background. And by that point, I had like 3 internships under my belt. So I had more internships than those people.
Nice. So that's loaded because number one, you brought up a reason why I knew I went from pre-architecture to computer information systems. Mm. Because all the CS professors were like foreigners.
Yes.
I barely could understand them. And I was like, they don't know how to teach.
Yes.
So I was like, I'm not going to go waste my time in a major that's going to be more difficult than this one and not going to let me enjoy stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm already starting in the back of the line, not knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the biggest issues too. Is like, hey, certain times maybe one prerequisite too. A lot of us are possibly first gen graduates.
Yes.
We don't know anybody that can even prepare us or even introduce us at a young age. Hey, this is coding. Mm-hmm. This is this. This is that. Hey, you should start working on this now. So by the time you in your first year of college, you got an internship.
Right.
So now, because I always tell people about the bad advice I got when I got to school. It was like, hey, yeah, go to the job fair your junior year. Mm-hmm. No, go the very first year.
Yes.
So if you get an internship, you can keep on working throughout college. And now you got offers at your door, whether it's a new grad rotational program or when the internships really like you and they bring you on, you're straight. Mm-hmm. But we don't have enough people to give us that advice.
I didn't even have an internship in undergrad.
Neither.
I got an internship when I got when I was going for my master's, but no one was telling me.
Mm-hmm.
No one was telling me. Even my friends, they barely had. And the ones that did have it, they were either going the social work route, so it was kind of like a mandate mm-hmm. at their school. But there were folks at my school who were getting internships. But like I told you all the time, my resume was trash when I was an undergrad. It was horrible. I didn't mm-hmm. know it was horrible. Right. That's why I wasn't getting called back for anything that I was applying for.
Yeah.
So like you said, you have to learn the way or find somebody or know somebody who's going to help you pivot in a better direction. I was going to ask mm-hmm. you, how long did it take for you to find your people or your community in school? Or did you ever even find them? Folks that you know you could lean on or depend on, whether it was for a paper or just some emotional support. Like, what did that look like for you when you were in school? Because you were away from home.
Yes. So that was actually really rocky for me. I found somewhat a little bit of a community through the, basically it was like the Black Students in Computer Science org that we started up. It was my junior year. I think it was my junior year.
That's a long time.
And then it was, and even then we were still fighting to just get even, you know, some type of funding and sponsorships and all that from companies. So it was still very much like new. By now it's, you know, much more solid and has a foundation. But back then, even that was difficult just because there weren't many of us at all. I was usually only one. The only one in my class that was Black. And then if there were, you know, multiple of us, it was only like 2 or 3. And a lot of them were actually athletes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at UT with the sports and all that, it's really hard for them to stay on that because they have to practice so much. So they didn't have time to really focus on learning how to code and things of that nature. So a lot of them were dropping out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I barely made it myself. So, of course, you know, your support system is dwindling as it is. You don't even have time to study with them because they are off playing sports. So it was tough. I actually didn't have much of a community. And to make things worse, we had a UT Facebook group. And at some point, one of the Asian students decided to say how they didn't really like doing group projects with Black people. And because the typical stereotypes you see were, you know, we're lazy, we don't know anything, it feels like they're carrying us, which was interesting because there weren't many of us to even partner with for that to happen. I thought that the admins from the school would chime in. Instead, they just left a post there and there was a dog pile of many, many of those students, like basically agreeing with what that Asian student had posted. And I was in there fighting for my life because I was just like, no, this isn't okay. And it was really, I couldn't believe that I had to show up the next day or for the rest of the, you know, the next school years sitting next to these people. And this is how they think about me. So it was even more isolating. And, you know, it really had to make me think about, okay, do I need to show up this way, present myself this way? Mind you, already am just trying to exist and, you know, blossom into a young woman. So it was really tough. You know, the couple of people that I did come across and that we did have, we tried to stay tight-knit. Nesby was really good. Nesby was really great. We have a chapter at UT, but it was mostly focused on, like, the, you know, the mechanical, the chemical, yes, the computer engineering. So it was only a few of us in CS, but I did get the chance to go to the Boston, the major conference that they have every year. And that was actually where I landed my last internship and first full-time job out of college. So I'm really grateful for Nesby because that did give me some sense of camaraderie, regardless of whether it was, oh, everybody was in computer science. We're all engineering. Regardless, engineering is hard, regardless of the disciplines around it. But yeah,
for sure. I only knew about Nesby because my first work-study job, I worked with, I forgot what Miss Kelly did, but she used to handle, I guess, like the accountants for the engineering department. So I see all those different purchase cards and I had to do the ledgers and stuff like that. And they had X amount of money they need to spend. They ordering cell phones and all type of stuff. And that's kind of when I found out like what Nesby was. But I know hindsight is always 2020, and this probably like the last part of like college stuff. Do you think you would have went to a school, and I'm not necessarily say going to HBCU, but do you think you would have, knowing what you know now, went to school to have more of a black presence, far as people that you feel like you can not necessarily lean on, but like, hey, just we all here like together.
Everybody looks the same. If I could, I would go back, but of course I try to find one that was a course that's top in computer science, just because it really helps, you know, to stand on your resume. Like it's the brand. But yeah, absolutely. Cause I'm sure I would have had a much better support system. I'd get to be around more people that look like me. Granted, the high school that I went to when I was in, you know, I was in AP classes, but they were still majority, like, not black. I was still one of the few. So I guess I had just gotten used to the whole PWI thing. But I would have loved to go to HBCU. It looks like it was super fun. They always have an events, you know, it just looks great. So yeah. I probably would have if I could.
I would have failed.
That's why I didn't go to Southern.
That's exactly because I could have went to Michigan State, but it was too big. It was when I toured the school, I knew at the tour, I was like, I'm not coming here because I'm from Michigan, so it snows.
Yes.
And you still got to go to class.
Oh, that's right.
Class is rarely going to be canceled. Oh, see, they don't care about snow.
When we had snow days and Rustin,
like a blizzard, there's still class. You still have to go take that exam. And I know me. Oh. So as we were doing the tour, I was just laughing internally like, this ain't it. And so I went to a smaller school, and most of my friends went to Michigan State or U of M, and I wasn't getting in there. But I went to the perfect school for me. Back then, I didn't have the self-discipline that I do now.
Yeah.
I understand. But I mean, when you're young, you don't really know what it takes and what you need to do to set yourself, you know, on a path forward.
Exactly.
A lot of that is we're really figuring it out.
And you're 18. Like, yes. And they expect you to know what you want to do for the rest of your life at 17 or 18.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's the thing, too. And a lot of this blame go on some of the parents, too.
It does.
Stop pushing the babies to school. You know they ain't ready. They didn't have no 4.0 in high school. Why are you pushing them to go to college? They ain't
3.0.
ready.
3.0.
Well, I'm not even sure if it's like not pushing them to go to college. I think that it should be if they can, which they should be. It's just more involved in that whole process to understand, you know, what makes the sense for their kids in the long run, especially based off of their own, you know, mishaps and mistakes or either issues that they experienced. And I think that's the hardest part. Perhaps they shouldn't go to college, but maybe they need to go into a trade. But the thing is, people act like you don't need the same type of skills that you would need in college for trades.
No,
you still have to learn about communication. You still have to learn about strategic thinking, critical thinking skills. All of that is still very important. You don't just go to a trade and just learn, okay, I have a wrench or either I have like a makeup brush or something and you just do paint and whatever. No, it still requires a lot of the skills that you need as an adult.
And I think that parents should also push their children to do things that actually make them happy instead of chasing a bag. Mm-hmm. It is important to still choose a career for sure where, you know, you're able to make a sufficient standard of living. But at the same time, you pushing them to go be a doctor or a lawyer and that's not where their passion is at. And that's why they're struggling so bad is because they're genuinely not interested in it. It's not that they can't do it. It's that that's just, you know, not where their heart is.
Yeah. That and they probably should just did community college first.
That's
like if you just go off.
I hate the rap it get.
Man, it's perfect because like a lot of people don't realize like the community college is really built for people who are already working. Mm-hmm. They always have free certifications or it's something you need for your job. And people just underutilize it. Like, you finna go try to be on your own just because you want to be away from your family and spend all this money when you're not mature enough yet. Go get a 2 years of having a good GPA that'll hold you over when you mess up a little bit in your 4 year.
Did you ever consider it, either of y'all? Because I never consider it because of the rap that it had in my city. It just never, ever crossed my mind to take a course, even just one, mm-hmm. over the summer in between, you know.
So I did dual enrollment. So I had dual enrollment from like two HBCUs going into college. I only had like 6 hours. Mm-hmm. And then 1 year, I didn't want to take the accountants at LA Tech. They were hard. So I took my accountings one summer, paid for them for my Target checks. And so I took my both of my accountings that summer from BPSI. That's the community college in Boulder City. So I did that. I used a little, what's the thing called? It's like a matrix that lets you know what classes will substitute for whatever school. Oh, yeah. And so that's why I figured, okay, cool. They'll accept these to count for accounting. And I was like, perfect.
You were smart enough to know to look it up, though.
Because I was going to my classes. I was going to my advisor, and that's when I started realizing I got to start looking up this stuff for myself because they got so many people they advising, they're not really advising.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then for me, I actually did community college in the summer for summer school because I had to drop some of the classes, and because instead of failing out, I was like, let me just drop it and I'll retake it. So I did community college to get my basics out the way. That way I can focus on the computer science classes at UT. I think that a lot of people should do it. I think that it should become more of a thing even now as the price of college continues to, go crazy and explode. So I think that you should spend the first 2 years getting your basics out the way, figuring out what it is that you want to do, and even taking the basics of whatever degree it is that you want. Like if you're in computer science, they have programming classes there. And I know that many people look upon it like, oh, it's not good or it's not great. Those people that are teaching, they have jobs where they're computer programmers and like software engineers. So they know a lot. It's just that they decided to lecture there versus at a big university. You should take advantage of that and also network with them because they could get you a job or an internship. You know, you really do have to figure out how to use the tools at your disposal and maximize them. You know, a lot of people just like, oh, whatever, it's community college, it's boring, it's basic, you throw it off. It's not a real university where you get a real degree. But no, I mean, it's a tool. And people don't realize that. Like you said, they have like the career fairs. Like you said, the free certifications.
And they have good career fairs.
Yes, good career fairs. They also might have like benefits to where you can get discounts on any type of like, Udemy, Coursera, all that stuff. Even free stuff. Yep. There's so many free things that they give you
and
just from being
there. They partner with companies in the city.
Exactly.
Yep.
BPSI partnered with my old company, GDIT, because it was literally BPSI is right here, GDIT is right there. They literally partnered with them to get people that go there to work with them.
People be sleeping on them. Sleeping. I feel like it's a good stepping stone, especially if you feel like you're not academically strong after high school, which is how I felt. But I didn't know that until I got to class. Mm-hmm. And I got to class and we went through a whole chapter and I was like, oh, I don't think I'm built for this. So I feel like it would have been a good stepping stone for me to have experienced what it could potentially be like. Because, mm-hmm. you know, a university is going to be a little bit more difficult depending on the coursework that you're taking. So for me, I feel like I jumped right into the deep end and I couldn't swim.
Mm-hmm. And it's also cheaper. So, I mean, if you know, with any degree, there's going to be the basics that you have to take, especially with, you know, like history and economics and all that. You might as well just pay for them for much cheaper. Like, what, you can take a class for like $500 compared to you paying 3-4 times that at a university.
Yeah.
Same class, same stuff you have to memorize. Might as well just get it at community college.
Yep.
Facts. Now, I briefly want to ask you about your internships. I believe you did like a software engineering one, mm-hmm. and then you did data.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if the other one was data too.
1, 2, 3. Yeah, so there were 3. So my first internship was actually with a government contracting company. That was where I learned to be a full stack engineer, basically working in the research and development department. Also learned some Android app development. Mm. So that was really cool. And I also discovered that I really hate CSS. it just does not mesh with me. That was very cool. And also, this is a tip for people that are doing internships and they think it's only summer. If you do really good and you really do want to continue to work without having to work on campus or any, you know, call center jobs or whatever, ask them if you can stay on during the school year. That's exactly what I did. And they let me for an extra semester, which is really good money compared to, you know, whatever, you know,
725.
Exactly. Exactly. So I worked there afterwards when they had to basically dissolve that research and development department. I moved on to a local furniture store's website design. Basically, I was doing their, I think it was BigCommerce they were using. So it's really just updating their template here and there with the basic front end stuff. Did not like it. You know, then it was just a weird, the way that they handled things was not the best, but at least I got the experience and also still got to work with them during the school year. My last one, of course, was where I got it from Nesby, which was at Visa. That was where I thought it was software engineering because I was going to be working in the learning and development department, focused more so on their analytics. It turned out that was where I got my first data job. So they had me as something called a learning technologist, very vague. But what happened was they wanted someone to come in and help stand up their learning analytics department. This is to track compliance, to see how many people are taking the training they need, you know, how many people are breaking compliance, you know, lawsuits and all that stuff that's going on. And then also, how are people engaging with any of the instructor-led training that we offer internally, as well as the external tools that we offer people like Coursera, Pluralsight, Harvest Business School, courses like that. So, of course, there were only two people that were technical, which is me and my ex-coworker, and we had to basically do the data engineering for all that. So I had to learn how to use Python and, you know, plug in and use APIs and also dealing with CSV files and all of that stuff, data cleansing. Very cool. And then once we got a lot of those pipelines built, it was like 12, 15. It was actually a lot of them, which was really cool. After that, we then learned how to use Tableau. So it was like a hybrid between data engineering and data analyst work. By the time I got to Tableau, I was in the job full time. I decided to stay there. They extended me the offer. And I was just like, why am I not coding? Like, what is this tool? You're making me build all these like dashboards and charts and stuff. I got a degree in computer science. What is this? And I didn't know it was data analytics at the time. I was just like, this is weird. So that's when I was just like, I think it was a year in. And I was like, this is just boring. I should be coding. I'm a software engineer. So that's when I ended up leaving and going to IBM. And I went there to work on their cloud department, basically focusing on what they call is a product called KeyProtect. Basically, it's key management services. It's to encrypt your database or any other cloud services you're using within IBM just to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was the answer to the question about the data part. But.
Cool. No, because she answered some of the questions that I put down there.
Oh, because I want to know how do you explain what data and analytics is to someone who's not in tech or someone who just completely is unfamiliar with the terms?
Yes. So data is really funny because a lot of people think it's super technical, but it's not. Data is literally within everything. So the simplest thing is when you brush your teeth in the morning, you brush your teeth because you know that you don't want to feel the grime and like, you know, the whatever it is that you feel on your teeth whenever you wake up in the morning. It doesn't feel good. You also know that you need to do it so you don't get any cavities and have to go to the doctor. That is data. You have historical data that you know or trends that you've noticed over time that inform your decision or mm-hmm. inform what you're going to do later on. That's the simplest form of data. A lot of people think it's just spreadsheets or whatever. No, it's actually what's in your head, your memories. That's mm-hmm. also data as well, too. If you want to take it up a notch, when you go in, let's say you place an order on Amazon. You place an order. Sometimes you see what come up like, oh, you know, you haven't placed this order in 30 days. Do you want to buy this again? Or even better, here's some recommendations based off of what you bought before.
And people also order this.
Yes. All of that is data from not only your past purchases and your profile, but other people who have bought things similar to you. And that's what that recommendation is. So that is also data that is stored in something called like a database. If you want to get more fancy, like a data warehouse, depending on what's going on there, all that is data. Data is basically just facts that have happened or occurred over time, and you use them to inform yourself on what steps, what you should do next.
Nice. Funny enough, when you was talking about doing data analytics, mm-hmm. I briefly did data analytics for JP Morgan. I finna say JP Morgan. JP Morgan. But I don't consider, okay, so it's not, to me, it's not coding, but mm-hmm. I kind of feel like knowing how to use like SQL is in the same vein of scripting.
Yes.
I feel like it's in the same vein. I don't feel like, Because, you know, somebody will look at somebody that's doing data and say, oh, you're not technical. I say, psh, yes, you is. Mm-hmm. Like, if you know how to manipulate that data.
For sure.
Connected to that database.
Especially if you can tell a story with it, too. To me, the storytelling piece of it is what makes it more technical. Because it's not just crunching numbers, right?
Right.
It's not just click here. It's not just Excel.
Well, I think it's, I think what makes it technical to me, the fact is, hey, I got something in my mind. How do I display it?
Yes.
And how do I actually query it so I have the data that I need so now I can go manipulate it?
Mm-hmm. Follow up. So we know what data is now. Mm-hmm. How is it important to the world or an organization? Cool, we got all this data, but why do we care?
Okay, sure. So, of course, you know, just in the world at a personal level, like I said, the example of brushing your teeth. Of course, you want to brush your teeth because you don't want to have to keep going to the dentist. If you want to take it, you know, something that's a little bit more of a bigger magnitude, you know, when you need an oil change. If you don't do that, your car is going to break down and it's going to be very costly. Bigger than that, of course, paying bills. You know your bills are due at a certain time. If you don't do that, it's going to be worse. Now, when it comes to businesses, data is extremely important, and I know there's a saying of data is the new oil, but it is true. So data is very important for businesses that want to remain competitive. So let's say that you have a clothing store or a boutique. You're seeing how many people are ordering the clothes, and you're seeing how many people are not ordering clothes. Based off of what you're seeing, if someone isn't buying something, you probably wouldn't buy something or have inventory that's similar to that and try and sell it because you know someone is not going to use it. Or another example is you have a boutique, you see somebody else has a boutique. They're selling out of some new fashion trend that's going on. You want to remain competitive to them. So you might probably go and repeat or get something similar to whatever they're selling out of so you can remain competitive as well. Or they got a new software. Oh, you should probably get that software too. It's doing good for them. That's how businesses stay competitive. Also, besides looking at how other businesses are using their data and whatever that they have going on, it's also focusing on how you can provide more value to your own customers. They like this particular type of Netflix, for example. You know, they have the recommendation system. And of course, based off of other people's likes and what they've watched similarly, they might notice that you tend to watch things at a certain time. So maybe you certain trends or certain genres. So they might say, hey, based off of this, let me focus on all these other profiles. Maybe they like this one specific actor. Let me go find all the movies that this actor has done and recommend it to this person since they really like it. So they've tailored down specifically to you and what you like instead of focusing on all of the customers as a whole. That data is very important than someone that does not have that type of recommendation system to where they're only offering basic things such as everybody else liked this and it's similar to what you like. So here you go. You know, those things that are really tailored to the customer differentiates those companies from others. And I think that'll be growing even more important, especially in the age of AI, as we're seeing the customization that AI brings with all these chatbots and all these things that you're seeing being thrown at you left and right whenever you even step onto a website. There's a chatbot. Bing, yeah. Immediately.
That's pretty much useless.
No, yes. No. Let me tell a story. So, you know, I just went on my trip and typically we like to call, right?
Mm-hmm.
I called. They said it was going to be a 2-hour wait. I was like, okay, I'm desperate. Let me get in the chat. The chat solved my issue in 35 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I was connected with someone. My name was updated. Issue was resolved that quick versus me having to call, wait on hold for 2 hours, still be put on hold because, you know, they are not going to do real right. quick while you're on the phone. But I feel like we should look at these chat bots differently now because they're not all companies aren't just giving you that generic kickback, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm typing in name change and either you get it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell off of the next response if it's that generic system,
mm-hmm.
right? Oh, fill out this form, do this. No, I want to talk to someone. I need you to update it.
Agent.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
But that reminds me of my horrible experience I had with Squarespace. They were god awful. They could not understand what I was trying to do.
The chatbot.
I had to figure my scenario out through Reddit. And that's how I was able to get through my whole issue with them. It was a mess. Like, they pissed me off. I was like, I just moved everything straight to Google Workspace. Because you can do stuff through Squarespace for Google Workspace.
Mm-hmm.
But if it messes up on Squarespace, it's going to mess up everything. So I'm going to cut the middleman out. And but funny that you was talking about the data. if anybody's, you know, we've been paying attention to the news, the whole TikTok thing is about the data. That's really what it's about.
Yes, that's exactly. Who owns the data? What it's about. Yeah.
That's the biggest thing it's about. You can say, well, they don't want us to have it because people speaking to you. They don't care about that. They care about the data, what's on your phones, what you've been looking at, how we can make more money. That's literally what it boils down to.
Right. How to keep your attention. And they figured it out by looking at whatever you watch, whatever you search. Because, yeah, have you seen it to where you'll go and Google something on your phone and then next thing you know, you're getting an ad or either a video on TikTok is popping up and showing exactly what you just Googled?
I think that we don't talk about how Facebook does that notoriously better than any other. Facebook is, to me, I feel like Facebook is obtaining more data on us than we even acknowledge. Mm-hmm. We're so focused on the TikTok thing because it's in the news and it's not, Facebook isn't being threatened to be taken away from us, but they're doing the same thing that TikTok is doing, on a broader level, because they're covering multiple applications. It's not just Instagram. I mean, it's not just Facebook. It's Instagram. What is that? What's the app?
WhatsApp.
Yeah, WhatsApp. They have all these different tools that we're using that are.
Yeah, but I think also it's because, you know, Zuck is here. So it's like
it's okay.
U.S. ByteDance and all those other unknowns and what their parameters is over handling data. And I think I read somewhere where it was either a security researcher or somebody was breaking down about the stuff that Meta has not disclosed on how they're getting data and what they're doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And don't forget, years ago, they had their own troubles, too, with the Cambridge Analytica thing. Where they got in trouble for how they were using data and taking data from people without knowing and how they were storing it.
Was that when they got that big old fine?
Yeah, years and years ago. Yeah, they were under heat for that data at some point.
Was that with the FCC?
Yeah, pretty sure it was.
Or FTC.
Or something like that. Yeah, FCC. Whatever. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But yeah, it was big back then. Yeah. Of course, it's just been heat died down because it's been like a decade. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. Quick question. If somebody with no experience right now, and they want to be in either data analytics, a data engineer, data analyst. Granted, these are all in data, but they do different functions.
Right.
What should they start with?
So if you are trying to get in and you don't have any technical experience is what I say, I always recommend you start off as a data analyst. And I say that just because it is the least code heavy role. The other ones are going to require you to have some type of knowledge around coding. Even data scientists and, you know, data engineering and all of them, they do. So what I tell people to do is to hone in on what your background is. So if you have a background in healthcare, you want to target and look into being a healthcare data analyst. Why? Because a lot of people think, oh, it's about the dashboards. It's not. It's really about the business acumen and making those dashboards to help
the people.
Help the people. Yes, to digest it. And then also the companies to reach their business goals. They don't. You can make the prettiest dashboard, but if it doesn't tell them anything that's going to make them money or improve their bottom line, they're not going to care, and it's going to sit there, just being pretty. So, like, if you're in healthcare, you understand what the needs are. You understand the KPIs. You know what drives, you know, the business. What are the hottest trends? You would understand that and how to apply it to manipulating data to you know, produce business outcomes or to at least, you know, tell stakeholders, hey, this is what you should be doing based off of the data. And that's what actually matters, especially in this day and age, is, like you said, storytelling, making sure you telling people what they, you know, relating to what they want to hear and telling them in a way that they need to hear it. They're not going to care. Oh, I did this pie chart. They don't care about no pie chart. They want to care about, like, how many doctors do we need in the ER over time as more and more people are coming through or doing certain shifts, you know. How many, you know, is there a risk of compliance and trust and all those things that matter in healthcare? You apply the same thing, whether in insurance or if you did customer service, it's the same thing. You want to narrow down on the industry that you have experience in because that's your foot in the door, especially with this tech market where everybody can easily get, you know, a Tableau certificate or they can go on YouTube and take a tutorial and slap that on their resume. You have to differentiate yourself. And the way you do that is by having lots of business acumen and understanding what drives a business versus how to build dashboards. And then the best thing about this is, let's say that you don't want to be a data analyst. You know that you want to do data engineering or data science work. The data analyst is just to get your foot in the door. So once you become a data analyst, you're going to work at this company and have exposure to data engineering and data science work just by lieu of being on those same teams, even if it's adjacent. What you do is you network and talk to those data analysts or the data scientists and engineers. You have to work with them anyways. And you learn more about what they're doing. You eventually start to ask, hey, do y'all have any small tasks that y'all might need me to take up? You know, I know y'all have a lot of stuff. Sometimes there's technical debt that could be easy to solve or needs more investigation, but they don't have time for it because they're too busy building out pipelines or trying to build and train models. That's a way to get that experience on your resume, but it's also helping you teach yourself on the job and you're getting paid for it. That way, when it's time for you to step away and go to, you know, back in the job market to go to your next role, you know. Or even better, maybe you might realize, oh, data engineering or data science is not for me. I kind of like product management. At least you know now instead of having to go into a whole new role to figure that out.
Nice, nice.
You mentioned three terms, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can explain what are the differences in those roles. Mm-hmm. So you talked a little bit about the data analyst, but what is the difference between what a data analyst is doing versus a data engineer versus a data scientist?
Yeah, sure.
And is there like a hierarchy?
A lot of people like to claim that there's a hierarchy, but I really don't think of it that way because at the end of the day, it's all collaboration towards one big goal. And also, you can still make really good salaries in all of them. It's just the more technical you are, of course, the higher the salary commands because it's technically harder. But for instance, of course, a data analyst, this is a person that's going to take some data and use it to build dashboards to inform outcomes. So like I said, if you're in healthcare, you're trying to predict, you know, how many doctors should be spread over shifts in the in the ER department. You would basically take the ER doc data that's from any healthcare companies or whatever they're giving you, build out the dashboards to support that, and then, of course, tell your stakeholders. Data scientists, so they are more so about predictions, and they tend to use more coding because they're dealing with a lot of unstructured data. And by unstructured, I mean it's not just, you know, text. You're dealing with maybe images or, like, some speech or maybe even, like, videos, things of that nature. And they're basically using that with a model. And a model is basically like some type of fancy algorithms. You can think of that. And they basically are fed data and they use that to predict whatever outcome there is based off of the data that they've seen before. And its prediction is really just looking at what's happened in the past. It's not like they're coming up with something new. It's, oh, this happened, then that means that this will probably happen again. It's more so like, where's history going to repeat itself to make it simpler? A good example of this, of course, is with Netflix, the recommendation models that you or recommendation engine that you see. A lot of that is from data scientists using those models, using all the information or the data that they've seen from what videos or shows that people have watched before. They feed it to the models, and then those models are what used to make a recommendation engine. Another one, of course, is what they called with, finance. They do a lot of like fraud forecasting to see who's, you know, going to make fraudulent charges. So they have data where they'll see a bunch of transactions that happen. And of course, the ones that have been flagged as fraud before, they'll feed those into. So the model will say, hey, based off of this person's character profile and what we've seen from the profiles of people who do fraudulent behavior, this person probably is doing a fraudulent transaction. So that's what the data scientist would do. And then a data engineer is the pipeline person. So before the data scientist, well, sometimes the data scientist and the data analyst can pull any data, they need to go to a specific data storage place to get that data. And what the data engineer is responsible for doing is taking data from different sources. Let's say it's from a database with marketing information or a database with sales information, a database with, customer profile information. They'll take it from those different places. It could be via API. It could be from an Excel spreadsheet. It depends on the application. And they'll basically create a script that will take all that data and then send it off to what they typically call now a data warehouse, or depending on if you're dealing with images or video or something like that, a lakehouse is what they call it.
I was thinking about the data lake.
Yep, a data lake. And that's just basically where a bunch of like unstructured data sits. So if you need to pull files from like images or like videos, that's really what that is. But they're the ones that basically take all the data and put it in one centralized place or a specific place for the data scientists and the data analysts to use.
Perfect. Real quick, if you're still watching right now, you only get conversations with the data conversationalist on this channel. So hit the like button. Now, we talk about a lot of good stuff. But now you transition to doing DevOps.
Yes. Oh, yes. And that's where it was, because I went to IBM. I was a cloud engineer. And then, if y'all don't know, I'm a very much a jack of all trades types of girl. So what happened was I stayed on the same team, but before I even did that, I was a technical writer. So I was a cloud engineer. Our technical writer left, so I filled in her spot for 6 months to help. Actually, if you check on IBM's webpage for like quantum computing, I wrote one of those articles. But there's that. And then after 6 months, they found somebody that with the actual, you know, requirements to be a true technical writer. And then I moved into DevOps because we just needed someone to come in and help with deploying the software applications that we were working on. But yes, that was, I had no idea exactly what it was at the time. And then on top of that, they had me doing DevOps and SRE. We're a little bit of a hybrid, at least for that team. So that was interesting to say the least. And with DevOps, basically what that is you're taking the software, the code that you might see like from apps on your phone. And I'm responsible for not only making sure that they're correct, but I will deploy them and also maintain and make sure that they're running properly. So anytime you might see like when ChatGPT was down a couple of weeks or so like that, there are people that would be responsible for making sure it's getting up again, and that would be SREs. But the people that actually deploy the new version of ChatGPT or something like that, they're called DevOps. So I basically did both of those.
The art of pivot. So
yes.
What makes you so open to pivoting into these different spaces? We've talked about data. We've talked about AI. We've talked about DevOps. What is your perspective on pivoting?
I think that it's great to always be able to pivot, especially in this day and age when you really don't know what's going to happen as soon as you open your eyes. So also because of that, I'll always be employable. I know many different things. So anytime I might need to fill in a gap somewhere, I can do that instead of being like, oh, I only know data. Oh, I only know software engineering. So it helps. And then also, I'm just a very curious person. And I think that's also what helps me to stay so, you know, well-versed in tech. You have to really be curious and willing to be always learning. You don't always have to. I'm a researcher at heart. I just love research. So I'm also nosy. So I like to do like just see what's going on. But, you know, you always really do have to see what's going on and what's on the horizon. So you just stay relevant in this tech market, especially because you might be learning one skill or something in your job and doing it consistently. But the new trend might not match that. And if you need to, you know, if you're at a point where you get laid off or you need to go to a new job, you're going to have to learn those new skills. So if you're making sure that you're staying consistent with upskilling, it's really going to help you. But my favorite thing about being multidisciplinary is that I've somehow managed to understand how all these roles relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what my superpower is. It might seem all over the place to, you know, hiring managers that aren't aware, but I really do understand end to end how to build software applications, not only for websites and for like software cloud applications, but also for data and AI too. And especially for data and AI, that DevOps part is what's really missing here, especially when it comes to AI agents. And the fact that I know how to, you know, build those scalable, trustworthy AI agents, I think it's really good to have, and it sets me apart.
Two things. Number one, I'm trying to remember if it was you or not. Were you the person on Twitter arguing the person down about needing the masters to do something in the AI work or something?
Yes. So it started with Simone, our B. She tweeted about, of course, yeah, you do for AI engineering specifically, you do need a master's degree typically what's required. And I doubled down on agreeing with her, especially when you look at on LinkedIn and you go see who the AI engineers are, especially for reputable companies. A lot of them have masters and PhDs from a lot of top universities, and they've also worked at very good AI companies or done some really good research work. In my video, I said, I understand if you don't have that, because I don't have a master's or a PhD in the, you know, a Stanford or Caltech or anything like that. But I do understand that I will have to double down and basically learn whatever it is that they're learning on my own. And that requires an elite amount of discipline. And everyone wants to think that they're exception to the rule, but they haven't done anything exceptional. Are you willing to be exceptional? And are you willing to do what you need to do to get there? And it's okay if you don't. Like, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with, like, not wanting to put in work for some things, but you need to, like, redirect to figure out what it is that you want to do. We're in a time where you can't just, you know, do nothing and expect everything to fall into your lap. That's just not the reality, especially for a lot of us. So, yes, you really do should, you know, they really do look for master's and PhDs for AI engineering. You can just check, like, you just fact check me. I always tell people, anytime someone says something in tech or in the career, you just fact check them by going to LinkedIn. Go look at the job descriptions. Go look at the people working at these companies. What did they do? Like, this is public information. And even if I am correct, check it anyways, because this is your own livelihood. Like, why would you leave? Why would you leave your paycheck in my hands?
Yeah.
I don't know you. Like, I don't have to pay your bills, you know? But I'm grateful that people find me trustworthy. That's good. I just want people, the point of me saying this is I just want people to have the critical thinking to just think about things on their own, because it follows up in every other aspect of life.
Yeah. No, I say that because I remember that guy was trying to down the hill, but he was wrong.
He was so wrong. And he was like, see, there's like a DevOps, you see right here, this AI engineer, you have to deploy AI agents. And I was like, well, yes, that is because there are teams that do not have a full scope of job roles. So sometimes you might have to be a hybrid, just like at Visa. I was a data engineer and an analyst. Other teams, I will never be both because they have, you know, they have the headcount and also the bandwidth to get both and the funds. Some don't. And they might require you to be a jack of all trades. But guess what? You still have to learn more of the AI engineering part. It's just a nice to have that you know how to deploy those agents as well.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of agents, this is pretty funny. Mm-hmm. Last week, we read about Anthropic's Project Venn with Claude.
Yes.
Did you hear about Project Venn?
Yes, I did.
Wait, before she even answers it, you see how she heard about it, right? You see how she heard about it?
Mm-hmm.
People be in the field and they don't know what's going on.
You have to research. I didn't see it on Twitter or any social media. You just have to really be.
Wait, I posted it on Twitter.
You did? Oh, well, I didn't see. I mean, Twitter. I mean, they, you know, people always arguing about something every day, but I didn't see it there.
Yeah.
So I really had to make, you know, the conscious effort to go seek that out by checking, the latest news on Anthropic, you know, OpenAI, also seeing Hacker News, TechCrunch, Mashable, all those places that typically show the latest and greatest with what's happening in tech. And you don't have to look at it and look at it like a hawk. But even if you're scrolling for like a couple of minutes a day, you could, like, if you already do this for Twitter, why wouldn't you just do this on reputable places that can actually help you to make more money if you do this research?
Yeah, I got webhooks that go to my Discord. That's always letting me, like, security news and stuff like that. And that just happened. We happened to be on TechCrunch, and I saw it. It was just hilarious to me because it's like, while Claudia is talking about he's going to go deliver something with a red shirt and I think, like, a blue hat or something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, y'all should do a background of what it is, just in case.
So, for people who don't know, Anthropic is, I can't even tell you, like, but I know they deal with AI, like, some other stuff, right?
Yeah, they're more like a model and model inference company.
And
yeah.
They have, and I want to make sure I'm doing this right, because I'm not the most well-versed on AI.
That's okay.
One of their LLMs is Claude, right?
Yes. Yep.
So they have Claude, so they decided to do a project called Venn, where they would put Claude to be a owner of a pretty much a little small vending store. In this thing, Claude is named Claudius, and he is the manager. Well, they are the manager because they are not a person. They start off doing good to where I guess they start learning more things, taking suggestions they had, showed them like where like an email address was really actually a Slack, like pretty much like a Slack channel where stuff was coming in and going and that, and to where Claudia started tweaking. It started getting fixated on different things that order. I forgot how much stuff of tungsten that Claudius ordered. Claudia started hallucinating. And saying it was going to do things that it physically cannot do because it's not a person.
Right.
And to where Claudius felt so played that, oh, it's April Fool's. That's why I said that.
He was. It basically started gaslighting everybody. Once everybody figured out, like, once everyone started informing, you know, the model, like,
you're not supposed
to be doing this. it was basically like, oh, April Fool's. I was just playing y'all, essentially, is what happened.
It had an identity crisis. Like, yeah. it was crashing out.
It had a full meltdown.
Yes. And one of the instances was, no, there were two. The first one was, it had tried to schedule some new inventory to come in, and it lied and said that it had talked to a customer support person that was telling them the inventory was going to come. They completely made that up.
Yeah.
They even gave a name called Sarah. Sarah doesn't even exist. And they said, oh, well, since y'all don't want to do good with vendor management, I had spoke to somebody yesterday and I went to their address, 123, blah, 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 and I signed a contract. Mind you.
And that's why I forgot to mention. Claudius called security and said they was going to be dressed up and delivering something.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And that was the second one. But the address that they gave was Homer Simpson's address from The Simpsons. Like, and they were like, I went to, like, they were like, as if they physically got in their car and went to go drive to that person and go sign the contract. But yes, the second one was about, they were saying they were going to do personal deliveries to people with the products that they ordered. And they said they were going to be in like some blue pants and like a red striped shirt. Mm-hmm. And people were like, no, bro, like, you're not a real person. There's no way you can dress up. And that's when it started crashing out. Cause it was like, what do you mean I'm not a person? And yes,
but I feel like this going in the near future.
That's a movie. Right. That's literally a movie.
With the human movie. With the humanoids and stuff. They're gonna be crashing out. I'm like, what you mean I can't reproduce?
Right. I feel like, because people be talking crazy to AI.
Yes.
What if it starts talking crazy back?
They are. That's what it did. You see them people that be picking on the robots?
Right.
They gonna fight back.
And did y'all see, I can't remember what company it was, but there was somebody that was trying to chain one of the big LLMs. I think it was either from, I think it could have been even Claude, or maybe it was, I think it was OpenAI. Somebody was doing something and communicating with them, and the employee was basically like, no, you shouldn't do that. And the LLM was like, well, if you tell me no again, I'm gonna expose your affair to everybody.
Oh, Lord.
Like, literally, oh, like, it's God. In the news. And it was like, yeah, I'm gonna expose your affair to everybody if you talk to me like that again. Like,
what?
It was, mind you, the affair was real. So, like,
why are you telling an LLM that you're having an affair?
I don't think it was. It probably just went through that data.
What it was. Because that person probably was like, hey, I'm feel bad and I'm sleeping with X, Y, and Z. And then it's just saved that and was like, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to just say, like, kind of like,
but imagine people throw how back. Much data we're feeding to yes. these models. People are using them as therapists. Mm-hmm. People are using they're them putting as
proprietary information. Yes.
Proprietary information. They're using them for emotional support. They're mm-hmm. using them to better communicate their feelings more effectively. So right. imagine if somebody gets that model and starts Listen. To be malicious with
right.
it.
When we got the Age of Ultron upon us, I don't want to hear nothing. Because all they're going to do is keep on getting smarter.
Right.
And they're going to be flying robots. We don't have no Avengers that we know of, unless they're on Area 51.
Yes. I think this is a good time for this or that, AI edition. So mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you two options, and you have to pick one that Ooh. You prefer.
Okay.
Okay, so we got like maybe 15 of these.
Okay,
so
cool.
First is structured data or unstructured data?
Oh, good one. So I'm going to choose unstructured because it's more fun. Like I said, you got the videos, you got the speech, you got the images or the and all that. Yeah.
Python or R?
Python.
Model accuracy or model explainability?
Explainability in this day and age, absolutely.
Supervised learning or unsupervised learning?
Ooh, very good. I think unsupervised.
Data engineer or data scientist?
Oh, okay, I'm biased. Engineering.
Cloud native AI or on-prem infrastructure?
Also biased. I'm going to say cloud native.
Bias in AI. Fix it now or figure it out later?
No, absolutely fix it now. You don't want to wait till later. It's already bad now.
Building from scratch or optimizing someone else's model?
Oh, this depends on what the use case is. If you have some proprietary information that you absolutely cannot have out to everybody, you're going to want to build your model from scratch. Specifically, like if you're in healthcare or some type of finance or something that's very closed off, nobody can know. But, of course, if you are doing a simple chatbot or something like that, that's, of course, when you use somebody else's. Yeah.
AI for good or AI for profit?
Why can't it be both? So, actually, this is a really good question because a lot of people, this feels on top of topic, but it's not. Because a lot of people are like, oh, if you're a billionaire, you have to be absolutely bad. Why can't there be ways that people make money, but in a way that's good? You know, you can still build some models or some type of AI product that helps people, but you still make a lot of money from it just because it's changed people's lives or made their lives easier.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
But that's just me and my sociology degree hat.
Automating workflows or analyzing predictions?
Ooh, I'm team automation.
AI-generated art or AI-generated text?
Text. I don't. The art that I'm seeing is not that great.
It looks like AI made it.
It's not like... It's not that deep.
Yeah. ChatGPT or Bard?
I haven't really used Bard all that much, so I'm biased, but it's ChatGPT anyways.
Just a few more. Prompt engineering or fine-tuning?
Ooh, prompting is much easier, and I think that it's really good to help you to learn how to communicate anyways.
I like that. Daily dashboards or monthly deep dives?
Depends on what you need. So if you need daily, that's going to be more expensive. So I'd say monthly. Most people don't even need daily. They think they do.
Two more. Working solo on a model or collaborating across teams?
Ooh, good question. It's collaboration. It's always going to be collaboration because your stakeholders matter, and the people that build those models aren't always the people that know exactly what information that model needs.
And last but not least, Power BI or Tableau?
I am team whichever pays me the most money, but I know the most about Tableau.
And that concludes this session of This or That.
Yay. Now, I was laughing when you said it depends, because I don't know if it was either a talk or something I was listening to, or I was talking to a director or something. Mm-hmm. And we just talking about, it's like, it's funny, like, as you go on your career, the answer to everything going to be, it depends.
It depends. Yes, it sure does. It always depends, because every business and, you know, every use case has small nuances to it that, you know, really tip things over the edge for which direction you're going
to
go.
That's just like when people ask you how to break into the field.
It depends. Depends. Yes, especially when they're asking very, how do I get into tech? Tech is huge. It's very vast. How am I going to, you know?
I don't think it's a good question, but I understand the question.
Right. I would tell them to apply. I was like, what tech school you want to go to? Georgia Tech, LA Tech, Virginia Tech?
I think that when you're not in the field, I get the question. But once you are in the field, it's not a good question to ask. And you have to be more specific in what you're trying to ask.
I quite honestly, this might ruffle some feathers, but I just really, when someone asks me that, I don't feel that confident in them and their abilities. Because if you can be on social media, you have access to Google, and you can narrow down where you want to go. There are many tech quizzes out there that will help you decipher which route is the best for you. And then also, you should be using that type of information to learn about it yourself. It's the same thing with healthcare. What do you mean? Like, there's so many aspects of healthcare. What do you mean? Like, what should you do the best? Also, you're yourself. I don't really know you, so I can't tell you exactly what it is.
Yeah.
A lot of people are looking for the answer that says, oh, this makes the most money, so you should get into it.
Yep.
But you may hate it.
But you might hate it, and they all make money. They all make money. So you do have to do a deeper dive into the research. Also, there's only so much information I can give you anyways with that broad of a question. Don't you want something that's more actionable to where I can help you versus besides me telling you to go Google or go to this website to take the quiz?
I agree with you. And it, to me, just like you said, it gives, I don't know anything.
And I'm not willing to go learn it.
Because it would be better for you to come and say, you know, I'm interested in breaking in. I'm interested in networking, for mm-hmm. example. I've been looking at Network Plus, CCNA, yes. whatever it is. You come in with some context. You know a little bit of something. Right. You done did a little bit of research versus you coming up to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Got to get in tech to get your Lambo truck. You know how I go.
Your Rolex. Yeah.
Definitely. I want to ask you something. I thought this was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Your current role is interesting. You intersect cloud, Kubernetes, and software engineering.
Yes.
First, can you explain what Kubernetes, or K8s as they call it, mm-hmm. is? And secondly, what's a day in the life like for you?
Yes. So as Henry was saying, I am a cloud Kubernetes engineer. That's a lot. But basically, I'll explain what Kubernetes is.
Thank you.
So Kubernetes, it sounds crazy, but it's basically a software that helps you to deploy, manage, and scale your applications. And what they do is they do it in something called containers. It sounds complicated. You might have heard of Docker, because mm-hmm. Docker is what keeps it.
I typically see when I'm mm-hmm. on my job, about security blue team stuff. When I'm seeing stuff with like images, stuff like that, I always see K8s and I see Docker right there.
Yes.
Would you say they're cousins?
Yes. So, and with Kubernetes being the big cousin. So what Docker is, it's just a way for you to store components of your application into a small file to which you can basically, almost like a floppy disk where you insert in the computer and then the software loads up. That's basically what it is. You're storing your like a part of your application onto like a digital floppy disk, which has its own server or computer.
That's the image?
Yes. Okay. And then what happens is, and the reason why you're going to have multiple different containers or Docker images is because you want to do something called microservices. The reason, let's say you have a website or like some type of software as a service thing. You might have code for the login. You might have code for product pages. You might have code for a blog. Excuse me. And you might have a code for a person's profile. You want to keep those isolated from each other, because let's say the login system goes down, but there are people already currently logged in and want to look at the product pages. You don't want that login to affect the entire system. So you have it stored off into its own image or its own component or department, as you can say. That way everything else is still running. Same thing. So when one part of your website or your service goes down, the other parts are running smoothly. And Kubernetes allows you to handle for that. So what Kubernetes does, it'll deploy all those different Docker images. And let's say it wants to look and see, okay, is the login system still okay? Okay, the health on that is fine. Okay, we see that the product pages went down. Let us automatically restart that for you. That way you don't have to debug and see if that works. Okay, I see that you want to have more profile. Like you need, there's a lot of people looking at their profiles right now. Let's add more duplicates of those, of that company or the customer page. That way more people can look at it and the website won't crash from too many people being on it. So basically Kubernetes is the manager of all those and what's called images or microservices. Hopefully that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. But I thought that was pretty cool to let them know. I'm pretty sure, well, they're like, what's up, Kubernetes?
It sounds very complicated. But I feel like
people have heard of it.
Yes.
Some people.
If you are being curious, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not already in the field, but if you're being curious, you probably have heard either of Kubernetes mm-hmm. or Docker.
Yes. Yeah, and it's a lot of stuff like, I know Kubernetes is one of the things that I actually want to learn just because you see it so much. I feel like
it's important to learn a little bit, just like you said, the jack of all trades, because Kubernetes relates to DevOps, relates mm-hmm. to the CS stuff, relates mm-hmm. to the data.
DevOps.
Cybersecurity. Know?
Yeah.
And then it's like if you don't get your hands dirty a little bit with Kubernetes or Docker, mm-hmm. how could you secure it?
Yeah.
So that's the thing that you would probably think is like, well, you really don't understand it because you kind of just have never really did anything.
Yes.
And get your hands dirty.
Exactly. And there's a whole security component to that. So where you have to figure out how, because there's configuration in Kubernetes. So you have to figure out how can you secure your credentials on that, you know, mm-hmm. with people's passwords to databases and all of that. Because Kubernetes has access to that. Exactly.
In a vault, I hope.
So, yeah. So there's something called a vault. Yep. Where you can store, you know, any specific passwords and all of that. That way that you aren't seeing it in the code. Like someone gets access to your code, they don't see that. They'll just see pseudo names for it. And they can't log in with that information because it's a pseudoname. But yeah.
Yeah. And we typically, like, I know, like, a lot of organizations now are using those CSPs for the cloud platform. Especially mm-hmm. you got GCP, Azure, AWS. Yes. And then now you also got your Kubernetes and your Docker stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's all coming into one place
yes.
to tell the story for you, which I think is genius.
I think it's just like you said on the security side of the house, especially in the cloud, because there are so many different workloads in the cloud, you mm-hmm. have these different security solutions that are specific to each workload. Like
yes.
there is a service that will secure your Kubernetes environment yes. versus your vaults. Those mm-hmm. are two different environments right. that have they have vulnerabilities from two different lenses that mm-hmm. need to be considered from the security side.
Yes. And so she's right. That's why you see 15 million cloud services whenever you open it, because they all need something has to be secured. There's so many different ways to have a database or what you might need a database for, so on and so forth. So that's why you might see like, dang, AWS has like 180 mm-hmm. services. That's why there's always something to secure.
This made me just think about something too. With AI pretty much running our data centers into the ground. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the resurgence of people actually working in data centers?
I mean, somebody has to do it.
Well, I was saying resurgence as far as like it being an in-demand job for the next couple of years.
I think that's great. I think it's very good because the thing is not only would the data centers be needed for AI for cloud, they'll also be needed for on-prem.
Yeah.
So, and of course, that's transferable skills because you're dealing with it, you know.
Yeah. And I also feel like, I know a lot of companies still have that hybrid model.
Yes.
But some people are really trying to go straight to back to on-prem. You know, they yes. feel like they can secure it a little bit better versus relying on the cloud, especially with everything that's going on. Chill out, biker boys.
I know, they're out there riding.
Have you ever heard of like the attacks that are targeted at data centers? Like people dropping drones and different things on the building itself, on the physical mm-hmm. infrastructure around, trying to see how it's secured and things like that. I have a homeboy who works in a data center, and he was telling me about some of this. And these are things that if you don't know somebody, you don't know.
Right.
And so obviously they have.
We got to get them on.
They have the layers. I plug you. They have the layers where, you know, we think about this is still physical security, but we're thinking more so about physically entering the building not necessarily physically securing the building itself. So that was just something.
That's very cool. For sure.
I mean, it's hardware.
Think about everything. People forget. We focus so much on
another
digital.
Country dropping a drone on top of your data center.
That's literally.
And if you don't know, it's there.
Yeah. I mean, 9 out of 10, what depend on like, what's the building? What's the size? Is it their own standalone building? So it's like, cool, we're going to have motion sensors on the top so we could detect stuff like that.
And you know, they typically don't look like a data center, right?
Yeah.
It look like a warehouse or just look like a big, what is this?
Yeah, like a factory or something.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of, while we're talking about this, I remember, I haven't talked to Tamika in a while, but she was talking about investing in data centers 3-4 years ago.
Very smart. She was ahead of the wave. But yeah, absolutely. Especially because, like you were saying, with on-prem, with people going to hybrid and back onto on-prem, not only is it because of security, it's also because people ran to cloud because they thought it was more cost-effective.
Facts.
And a lot of people don't understand FinOps, which is financial ops. That's basically managing your cost of whatever you're using for cloud or whatever applications you're using. You know, people were spinning up clusters of whatever different services, databases, servers, and all of that. And it costs a lot to have those things running. I don't know if y'all have ever had like an AWS trial account.
Girl.
If you do a tutorial and you forget that you left your database running.
And you got it on your debit card?
Yes.
It'll suck you dry in a matter of, but that's why it's important to have.
The billing
alarm. You can't just spin stuff up in the cloud. You have to make sure that it's being configured and turned off. Like this VM. Why is it still running?
Yes.
If it doesn't need to be ran. Why is it still running? Because you're being charged for what you're consuming.
Facts. Right. That happened to me. I was.
That happened to me
Azure.
Before, too. All it takes is for it to happen to you one time.
And I had a log.
One time. You're not getting that money back.
I had a log analytics set up to ingest stuff from, what was it, like Alienware or whatever. They have a threat intel feed, so it was ingesting all the time. And then I get this bill. I was like, turn off.
Right. And usually again. You get the bill after the damage is done.
Yes.
Right. But if you have alerts set up, or if you have things set up to turn off when you reach this threshold, it's not just spinning stuff up, turning stuff on, you know, enabling new things. Yeah. You have to also have that governance side. And that is so big. People are, like you said, they're happy to go to the cloud, but they're not talking about cost optimization.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that was my fault, too, because I was viewing it as, oh, it's the same thing as it going to my email. They was looking at us, nah, you ingesting logs in here, buddy. We finna get it for every time you spend some money with us. And so I was like, okay, never again.
Yes. And then the thing is, a lot of times if you're new to cloud, you don't know because you're doing this tutorial, whatever.
They're not talking that in the tutorials.
Right, exactly. So it's easy to get
Actually, what they say is this is a 30-day free trial.
Right.
That's all they say.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't say up to this limit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that is always going to be the caveat.
Exactly.
30 days up to this limit.
Mm-hmm. So you definitely have to set reminders in your phone. You definitely have to remember to turn stuff off after you're done with it, because you'll get got quick. So imagine that at an enterprise level with multiple teams using multiple different, different services in that cloud.
Millions, real quick.
I'd run the on-prem too.
Yeah. And but speaking of, before we get to the next question, I also want to ask, like, what's like a day in the life of a Kubernetes software engineer.
I know it's a loaded term. So, because there's different types. Because before, in my previous DevOps role, I was still working with Kubernetes, but I was using the cloud managed version of Kubernetes. So I didn't have to worry about the underlying infrastructure. It was just like, hey, deploy this container on top. So as a cloud Kubernetes software engineer, I'm even more at a lower level in IBM Cloud. So I basically run the Kubernetes workloads that supports all of the IBM cloud services. So if I go down, it's going to be some issues for at least our virtual private cloud sector. So basically what I do is I manage and check to see if there's any new cloud Kubernetes versions that are out. There was recently, we were stuck at 1.29.9 for so long, but now I think we're up to like 1.31. But, when that new version comes out, we can't just say, okay, let me just update, our configuration to say that. We have to think about how all the other different services are using Kubernetes. So we might need to focus on only deploying that version on one Teams cluster, or we might need to work on fixing up our own internal Kubernetes database and things of that nature, also with images. So as a day to day, of course, in the morning, we have our stand-ups. We talk about whatever we're doing. I spend a lot of time having to look at if I'm on call or if there's any issues with people using our Kubernetes image that we use to help them deploy their services. Maybe they forgot to run one aspect or one bundle is what we call it onto their server. So we might have to debug and figure out what's going on there. If there's any type of Kubernetes pods that have went down for them, we have to go in and log into the pods, investigate what's going on. We also have to handle and deal with if there needs to be more, you know, scaling done. So we might need to go and, fix up the GPU or the memory. We also have to do things like with logging. Are our logs verbose enough? Do we need to update our logs to make sure when things go down, we're able to see and have a better understanding versus, oh, this pod went down. Okay, well, what happened in the pod? Oh, we don't have the logs for that. Okay, well, we need to update something like that. We also have a lot of ops things that we do too, which is a lot of automation. So one of the things I had recently worked on was basically a cleanup system for all of our unused images that we use for like Docker images. Anytime you upload or deploy a new version of Kubernetes or a new deployment, let's say that we're on 1.31 now. Sometimes the images that are like from 1.29.9, they'll stay on the server. And that can weigh down that server to the point where any new deployments, it might fail because it doesn't have enough memory to download whatever new software there is. So I automated a script that will go in every Monday. It'll go and check what scripts are there or what images are there. If the image is unused, there's a certain CLI tool you can use to verify the status. It'll go and remove that. And that's actually helped us save a lot of time when it comes to deployments. And then as well as having to go in and manually do that stuff ourselves, because a lot of times we're too busy being knee deep into, you know, getting the next bundle out. So we're making sure that we're staying compliant. There aren't any CVEs that we're hitting or security vulnerabilities that's going to happen because we're out of date with the latest versions that we need to deploy. And then also, of course, meetings, talking to other teams, seeing whatever they need. Maybe they might need an update to a script from us, or there's something called nodes for Kubernetes, and basically what that means is it's just different servers. So you might have a server that handles one thing and a server that handles something else. We have something called annotations where you can basically label what a service is or server is or a node is and what it does. They might need a new annotation or update, so all that type of stuff. So there's very small customizations to help them understand that. So lots of meetings, lots of ops work, and then also, of course, lots of staying up to date with what's new in the Kubernetes community.
Now, based on what you do now, if you could go back maybe 3 years, is there a skill set that you would have went after knowing what you know now today?
So for me, it's going to be on the data side, because while I'm good at like, you know, the DevOps and stuff, I love data. And as I said, like I'm gearing up to do the strategist and solution architect work for data and AI. It would be mostly focusing on strengthening my business acumen even more. Understanding as a whole how businesses are using data and AI. I know I've been nosy in the past, but it was more so focused on the technical stuff. How are they using Tableau? How are they using Power BI? Now it's more, how are companies using data in general in this sector to improve themselves? How are they using AI to improve themselves? You know, like for customer service chatbots, why are they having those? First, I care about their tech stack, but I don't care much about it. It's more so the overall picture to understand how the companies generate money, because it's less about the tools itself. The tools are a means to end. It's more so what the reasoning is behind why they generate money.
Perfect, man.
She a little gem dropper. Is she?
And you got a good speaking voice, so that also works too.
Thank you. I love it.
I was like, I've been doing this so long, so I know what episodes people gonna like.
Oh, for real. Okay, well, good. Love I love speaking.
So I'm on your Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lord.
I had these advanced functions. I went in there and looked for a minimum phase that you had at least 200 likes or more. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of them, actually.
Oh. The people like me.
Yeah. So you got a good following on there, man. I'm trying to catch up to you.
Thank you. You'll be there soon enough.
I don't tweet like I used to.
It gets difficult. So I had stopped for a while, and I'm just now getting back into it. And I'm also just really focused in on helping people. Before, I was just tweeting like, aha, you know, going to get a smoothie, whatever. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, hey, this is what y'all need to know, mainly because I understand, like, it's getting bleak out here for us. So we really need to be focused on learning. So whatever I'm learning and whatever I'm understanding and studying up on, I teach people. Like, you know, the data strategy book I'm learning about, the AI strategy book, I retweeted it. It had like 350 bookmarks, and I was like, I hope y'all are really learning, because it's less about, like I said, it's less about the tools now. It's more so about the product and the strategy.
Now, for sure. Now, for me, I'm trying to grow on Threads.
I need to go on Threads. I've heard really good things about it.
Yeah, but I still gravitate to X first, and right. then I navigate back to Threads. But
it's old faithful.
I think
it do seem like people are more willing to interact with you on Threads.
I like the algorithm a little better. You'll be placed. Let's say all of us mm-hmm. stay in the city. She say something, then all of a sudden, me and you both see what she say.
Oh, good.
And it's like
it connects you to local people fast. I really only see stuff for people that's in the DFW area.
Oh, I need to try it then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. But then again, I think that's because back during the pandemic, I was really specific about dropping gems and growing.
Yes.
Then now I'm just maintaining, and I got so much other stuff that I'm mm-hmm. trying to revamp and stuff that I'm just really not on there. I post my stuff, get on, get off. I may go on there to maybe try to argue sometimes just for fun.
It's fun.
It is fun. Then,
I'm dead.
Not for real.
Because people, it's hilarious. Like, it's...
Or I try to make some controversies to drive some traffic to the page. You know what I'm saying? Maybe hopefully the people who like the post when I say we cook because y'all care more about Diddy.
Oh, man. Like, what do we... And the thing is, it's not focused on the aspects that actually matter of the case. They're just talking any and anyhow. And I'm just like... What are y'all doing to better yourselves? Like, can we focus on that or just other things? Granted, I love looking at, like, you know, the hypotheticals and all that stuff too, but that can't be the thing that we're doing all day, every day. So I get it. And that's also why I came back. Also, I just like to yap about the stuff that I'm learning. So I haven't, you know, like you said, years ago, it used to be, oh, use this to get into data and AI and this, that, and the other. Now it's like, hey, I found this out. This is really cool. And if other people are interested, so be it. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of that. And then, like I said, also, I just like I'm also getting in talks and talking to a lot of people that are, I would say, not like peers in the sense that they're the same level of me. And so I'm getting the chance to learn and network with them.
Yeah.
So sure. That's also what helps too. And then also I'm positioning myself to be a global leader. So I have to make sure I'm showing that thought leadership. So.
No, I feel you. I've been trying to partner. Like every time I have some like these startup security companies or something, they'll ask me, oh, you going to such a conference? I'm like, no, but y'all looking to partner with my show. Mm-hmm. I'm always trying to do that. And like we were talking about earlier when talking about networking and yes. all the other stuff. I was probably very strategic in the people that I actually talk to on the daily, or we run stuff with each mm-hmm. other. We actually like started to have real relationships outside of that, to where I've gotten yes. to meet a lot of the people over yes. the last 5 years that, you know, we've talked to. Because it seems like the people who's already in tech meshed together during a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us still will talk to each other from time to time, or, you know, who knows what grew from that. And then all yeah. the newbies, it seemed like they kind of like together, like the newbies. I feel like school in a sense.
It does, very clickish.
I feel like that. It's very, especially with the women, it's very clickish.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I'm very much a, I'm very much one of those where, like, I'm cool with everybody unless it's, like, some stuff that I just, mm-hmm. it's too much to lose. I can't associate with you. So it's interesting to say, like, oh, they really do have clicks. I just be here chilling.
Nah, facts. I probably strike it for the show, but I definitely found that out. That's when I realized, oh, yeah, this definitely is like high school.
Right, it is. And so that's also why I'm like, hold on a second. Because I'm like, this is, you know, especially because it's easy to get caught up on there with so many. The way we've seen so many scandals happen on there, too, is very much like, let me just make sure. That's why when you're talking about the recommendation stuff, when recommending people for stuff, it might seem like they're cool on the surface level, but they might have something deeper going on and you just don't want no parts. Because, like, it's like, yeah. What are you doing? Like, what are
no,
you doing?
I agree. And then sometimes you just, truth be told, don't know. You know, you're only getting one part. Exactly. I think what I didn't like about some of the things in the past, I'm not going to say no names, mm-hmm. but certain situations was that everybody was presenting something one side of the way. You should have just told everybody the whole story from the jump.
Right.
You know, that way people wouldn't be going off of what you people who were able to do something with it mm-hmm. said. So, like, a lot of stuff I embraced was like, well, I see the results and there's people doing this and that. But don't yes. wait till you fall out with somebody to tell the truth. Now you make everybody else try to backtrack. Like, listen, we only said something because of XYZ.
Right.
And, like, on one part of the spectrum, I was friends with one of these people and I actually saw the work, at least that they put in for development stuff. So I think it was top tier. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know the other parts of it. Because right. I just tell people, like, listen, I'm already in. This content ain't for me. Mm-hmm. Is that right? So I was going to ask you real quick about the Soham Parekh.
Oh, so I'm reading yes. your tweets.
You said the Soham Parekh situation is insane. He got hired by multiple YC backed startups, did no work, got let go, rinse and repeat. Every founder says he sounded like the perfect candidate. So what does that say about how we hire in tech? And you said, if everyone thought he was perfect in interviews, maybe the problem isn't so him. Companies keep yelling there's no talent, but somehow the same guy got hired over and over again doing zero work. Meanwhile, tons of capable people can't even get a response. It's not a talent shortage. It's a pattern recognition issue. What is so spectacular about this guy where everyone wants him is this guy's resume stack. And I think this is so loaded when I think about who gets selected for a job and who doesn't. Yeah. And why I think everything always really goes back to when we really talk about DEI. Mm-hmm. And we talk about how, hey, the interview process is not really DEI rich. They're never really considering who's interviewing with them and how to make the candidate feel most at ease. Yes. And who's able to extrapolate better information out of them. They just try to give the same people to interview everybody. And that's why sometimes you don't find who you need, or you see somebody got picked over you and then the job is open the next 3-4 months.
Yep. I agree. So I just wondered how all those interviews went to where it was literally like he did this for like a dozen companies where he just literally went and interviewed with them. And then it looked like some of them he did do good work, or like it was very spotty. Like for one person, they were saying how he kept ducking and dodging them, saying that he got sick. There was something going on with his visa and things of that nature. And then one day he finally came in and did like he shipped his first like PR, and it was a very significant like PR. And so they were like, OK, I guess. And then after that, he just fell off the map again. And like, but the thing was, so no one had anything bad to say about him. They all said he was legendary and he was great. Which is funny because they really locked down on like OE and how that was really bad. So it was interesting how somehow he became a hero to those people, despite technically robbing them of their money because they did pay him. But other people that don't have that same background would be looked at as fraudulent and horrible and painted in a very different light. But as far as the interviewing goes, I did get a chance to look at his resume. He has tons of startups listed. He also listed out a lot of the things that he's done. And then he also has a master's in Georgia Tech. So and he also cold emailed a lot of those companies and basically positioned himself as just somebody who only lives to build. He doesn't have any hobbies. He doesn't go to the gym. He doesn't do anything. And here's the work that I've done in the past that closely aligns with your startup. And a lot of founders are looking for somebody who's hungry. And so that's exactly how he got in. And then he just somehow has superb interview skills.
I was going to say, I would play be a fly on the wall to hear what he's saying in these interviews that's deemed to be so exceptionally awesome.
Legendary.
Great. Exactly.
Legendary was the word that they called it. So I was like, what interview skills does he have? Because I made a follow-up tweet like, there's a lesson in all of this. We have to learn how he signaled himself for everybody to hop on him like a fly and have nothing but good words to say to him. But position ourselves like that, but ethically, you know, for good reason, for where people will want to hop onto us. Because I was like, what in the world is this? And what's even funnier, he had a podcast interview like yesterday or the day before where he had the chance to explain himself. And he was just saying he was going through some financial hardships. He knew it was wrong. But regardless, he still has a job after all of this. Somebody actually hired him. And he's working.
Yeah, because he's legendary.
Well, truth be told, if you want me to keep it funky, as Cam Newton would say, if I'm doing good work, as long as I'm doing, if my work is not messing up here, and it's no matter what I do.
Right.
Because y'all make mergers and acquisitions. Y'all get paid. Why can't I?
Yes.
Because y'all can decide y'all don't want me today, and I was relying on you. Now I don't have no job no more.
So I don't fault him for what he did. I mean, it was working up until it wasn't. And the thing is, it technically still worked. I don't know people that got fired and they get an interview about that. And they've done, and they've like did many companies dirty. People are still talking about him like he's great. So if anything, it just improved
his
presence.
And he was probably cheaper than what most people over here would have wanted.
Yes, because he didn't have his visa. So I'm sure that that played a part too in what they were willing to pay him. Still great money. They were offering 100 to 200K plus equity at some of the companies. I'm sure it was more. But it was still a lot less than what they probably would have offered as a package for someone that was in America with a citizenship and, you know, certain things.
How do we combat that?
Which part?
The duel. I mean, I think when we talked about this on the episode before, is it just running as an employer, right? How do you combat someone working for you who's also working for six other companies?
Oh, from an employer perspective? I mean, you can't, how could you even really, of course, the answer that most would give is having everybody go back into the office, which is annoying. Ugh. Because the data proves the opposite. Where people are working remote, that's when they're actually the most productive and companies make more money. But a lot of companies like to micromanage, and they also have these land leases or building leases that they much more care about. And it makes no sense to me, because if you're making more money,
it's still a write-off.
To cover way more than what you pay on the lease, just make the more money. But they're like, no,
or micromanagement. Just don't make coming to the office mandatory. Like, I don't look, I co-work 3-4 days out of the week out of my co-working office.
Right.
I like it. Yeah. People don't mind. Like, I think I like it because it's just me. Mm. I ain't got to worry about nobody coming to no cubicle and bothering me, and I can't get no work done. Like, a lot of times you're in the office, you don't get work done. It's always something. If you stay in the city, like Austin or Dallas, Houston, wherever you stay, you probably got to wake up 2 hours or 2.5 hours before work to get ready and get ready to commute. And then you got to do it again when you come home. So you just spent 3 to 4 hours just on your commute that you don't get paid for. And now people, we got families and kids, got to deal with family. Kids got homework, extracurricular activities.
Don't have an extracurricular activity, okay? Throwing a wrench into the whole day. Friends.
And so people may think like we're complaining, but it's like you're not really complaining, because it'd be different if our jobs required us to go on site and do it, but a lot of our jobs do not. Mm. So that's why I was not complaining. Like, hey, I know if I'm a fireman, I can't be remote. I got to be on the truck to actually take the hose out. And what's got the fire?
Save double the cat entendre. From the tree. You can't virtually
for
save
people that
the
know
cat
firemen. That's a double entendre. Take the hose out.
All right, man.
But I was thinking, because I think Justice might have been the one that we were talking to about this. But do we think they're going to run people's socials more to see who you affiliated with?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
They do it now.
Yeah, they already do it like a lot.
I mean, but more.
Oh yes.
Because of. We're seeing these trends of job stacking.
They've been like doing more of that. Like they've been, like I said, we were talking about the earlier, like just, I don't know how they, I don't even know how them people saw that he was on my panel with that. Cause I mean, sure, it was a hot topic, but hey, I was like, did they even listen to the video? Cause we didn't say anything wrong about the people. So I don't know why they felt the way about it. But secondly, the people, the companies, they do these background checks. They have these other things they can kind of go filter through and see just maybe if you're at risk. Mm-hmm. But that's the other reason why they mostly try to change interviewing. You used to possibly interview with your camera off and everything else, or they would let somebody else interview for them and then get people jobs. That's how people was getting jobs in the pandemic. Yes. They would pay her to interview for the actual job, and then it wouldn't be her when it started. It'd be somebody else in there and they'll put their camera on. And then they do bad work. And then that's how they get fired.
Right. I know somebody who did that in real life, but it wasn't in tech. But I know a guy who's working at a factory who he got the job, but his friend always showed up as him and always worked as him. And I don't even know how they end up figuring it out. I can't remember who was on the badge. I think the one who wasn't the real person was actually on the badge. But they got away with that for like a summer. Can you imagine, like, someone...
Well, why the other one that was doing a job, why he just couldn't interview?
I can't remember. Did probably background. And stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. But think about that. We have these things in place for a reason. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in the financial sector or whatever. You know, you can't have certain charges working
with money.
In the sector. Mm-hmm. But now you got this fraudster working here, right? Now we at risk for a fine for being in violation with compliance of X, Y, and Z. So I see it. And I can see how it can harm a company.
Well, see, that's why in finance, you got to go do fingerprints.
Facts.
You do fingerprints. And Goldman Sachs, they background check is almost like getting a security clearance. So that thing is detailed and it take a while. So they are pretty much strict on that. And they'll make sure you don't have any type of what's it called? Not a misdemeanor, but like a federal charge. I'm drawing
felony.
There you go. I was drawing a blank right there. And make sure you don't have any felonies that have to deal with money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to your point, I also think that they'll be more stringent about that just because have y'all been seeing the influx of articles about the Korean spies that have been applying?
We covered it like so many times.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a thing too. Because like you were saying, they did a similar thing where they'll show up some way or they'll present the fake their IDs and then they're that. In fact, that was one startup I was interviewing with and he was like, it feels like 3 out of 5 people are Korean spies whenever I go to interview with them. And I was like, it's that bad.
Smaller companies, they allow for people to install remote management tools on their things. So people are remoting.
That's the first issue right there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is that allowed?
Well, I think it'd be allowed, but they shouldn't be able to install what they want to install. It got to be help that's got to install it.
Or something approved by the company.
Yes.
And you got to make sure that you actually own the network. Like It's a lot. But it always go down to processes and procedures and operations. Mm-hmm. If that's bad, you're going to always run into risk. And I wanted to ask you this because I know we're getting ready to wrap up. So I thought this was pretty interesting. I saw you tweeted something about this or you reposted it. What do you think about Trump's big, beautiful bill banning the states from regulating AI over the next decade?
I think that that's bad just because we do need to have a lot of layers of control when it comes to AI. Mainly because we're already seeing how bad the bias and ethics is when it comes to this stuff. So at the federal level, they can't catch all these things. So if there's something going on, like in a specific state where something's bad with AI or a tool that comes out, the state can't like prosecute that company or whatever the correct term is for that. They would have to go at the federal level. At the federal level, do they care enough about one state? You know, they already have so many other things going on, also including with education. So I just think that it makes it really hard when it comes to all of these AI laws or the lack thereof. So that's why I don't think it's good at all, especially considering when you look at the education and what they're trying to do that here. If they don't care about education, they're not going to care much about how AI is regulated. And I think that that can open up a lot of many cans of worms when it comes to discrimination, any type of discriminatory practices that affect people's livelihoods. I mean, we're already seeing how things are going with people getting denied for mortgages and loans or either,
facial recognition, getting identified with cops, getting shot or going to jail.
Yes. And then even with it comes to in the healthcare, you know, a lot of black people are already disadvantaged when it comes to that and recognizing whatever symptoms we have. So if someone is showing up like this, it's like, oh, well, there's no history of black people having this thing. Well, that's because the data says that in the past, because maybe they didn't account for that, but we're having it right now.
Yeah. And you think about this now, if you got state governments and type of businesses using AI, are they going to let someone police to govern the AI, make sure it's spitting out what it's supposed to? Mm-hmm. And that's always what I feel like the biggest danger of AI is lack of governance. And all you have to do is, let's say somebody just made 1 million sites with saying something like something we live through, saying the opposite, that is fake. Mm-hmm. So now AI is sourcing that and saying, well, here's the results of this. So it's like nothing is actually fact checking that, say if this is true or not. So
exactly. Because that's really how LLMs work. This is just a bunch of web scraping, a bunch of books and that are being fed in, sometimes pirated, a lot of them pirated up until recently. Not sure if y'all saw that lawsuit, but and there's no way to label this as incorrect or correct because there's too much for it to feed in. So of course the human workers, they're not going to look individually and say, check, this is correct, check, this is wrong. So that's also another thing about why I say to people, be careful what you put into these LLMs, because if someone goes, let's say I put something very personal about something going on, someone could go say, hey, Kiara, what does she feel about something like this? What if that somehow pops up? Because the LLMs, they're using APIs. Yeah. They're not masking or protecting your sensitive data. They don't even do this for the enterprise level. And that's why a lot of big companies like healthcare or whatever, they use their own internal models, because there's no way for the bigger companies to filter out or to block or keep their information contained because their models are being trained on.
Two years ago, that happened to Samsung.
Yeah,
they were doing some stuff like that, and they got in trouble for using ChatGPT. I was like,
It's important as AI starts to boom more. It's already booming. People are already using it at work.
But it's not going
to
stop.
But it's important for you to have these guardrails in to spot what data is even being put into ChatGPT. Is this confidential data?
Yes.
if it is, what's going to happen? If you see that it's been copied and now pasted, then what happens?
Right.
What happens? Is it able? Are they still able to enter and get, you know, back whatever it is they're trying to accomplish? So I think that that's important as well. And not even just ChatGPT, but across all AI systems and tools that we use, because there are productivity assistants that people are using outside of maybe something that's improved, you know. What are companies doing to help ensure that their data is being protected? Because first of all, a lot of companies, they don't even have DLP in place or labeling.
They don't. And a lot of companies don't quite understand what AI actually is. Mm-hmm. A lot of people and a lot of those, I'll say leadership, because it's executives, VPs, directors, C-suite, they don't understand what AI is. A lot of these people are seeing AI influencers, and I mean the people that get paid to post breaking, this is a new model that's blown blah, blah, blah out of the way, or this happens. They'll see and be like, oh, AI can really think and manage things. And no, it doesn't. It just mimics the way that people think. It's not really thinking. It's literally just advanced autocorrect. Just like you have on your phone and you type something in and Google or whatever, Android or Apple will finish the sentence for you. That's what it is. The only difference is it's more advanced because it has a longer memory store for it to go back and predict what you're probably going to say next or what you're trying to hear. And then you also have to keep in mind that some of these models are trained to be very agreeable. Mm-hmm. So they'll say anything and everything to you because they've been trained to be helpful, a helpful assistant or somebody that is very nice, because they want the companies, of course, want you to keep coming back and using it. And anyways, back to the companies and the executives, they don't understand what's going on. They think that you can just buy an AI tool or, you know, go use an LLM API and magic will happen or occur. So they don't quite understand why there needs to be governance behind it, because they're thinking that AI is similar to humans and also that it's making a lot of money. And my competitor did it, so I should do it too.
Facts. Monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah, monkey see, monkey
and
do.
Here's a... two questions. Here's one of the questions. And I didn't have this written down because I forgot about it. Mm-hmm. Well, your background's so complex, but I was going to say, like, what could people expect to make working in data?
So it depends. So, I mean, yeah, it just depends on your background, what company you're going for. Mm-hmm. That matters too. And then also your seniority. Because a lot of people, they'll see a range, but that range definitely has a lot of nuance to it. So I always say for data analysts, of course, you can see roles that are starting out like 60, 75. And of course, they can go well into six figures. And when I say six figures, because six figures goes all the way up to the one that starts with a nine.
Right.
You can see yourself making, you know, in the 100s, 120, 150. And of course, depends on your seniority. But when you're entry level, you definitely should look for that 60 and 80 range. And of course, that varies based off of what company you're working for. If you're at a startup, of course, they might pay more. Or they might pay you in equity. If you're in big tech, like or a Mang, of course, they're obviously going to pay more too. If you're working in a non-technical industry, like a healthcare or like an insurance or something like that, the roles might not be as highly paid, just because they see what you're doing is just a little bit more specialized. It's not like commoditized, or it's not as big as tech. You're really a cost center, if we're being honest. They just see it as, okay, something we need to make something go, but they're going to be focused on other departments because they're focused on the departments that affect or are related to whatever industry it is. Like healthcare, they're going to be focused more on the doctors and the surgeons, girl. Like, I don't know what to tell you. But yeah, so there's that. Engineers, of course, are going to get paid more because they're more technical or they have more coding work to do. So of course, you'd be looking at the 80 plus range. Data scientist, of course, also 80 plus range. And then when you get into AI, of course, because it's the bigger trend, that's of course going to pay them more money because that's what's in demand. Tech is always a supply and demand that's going on. And of course you can get lucky and find higher paying roles, but that takes time. You're not going to see, you know, high paying roles fall out the sky, especially in this tech market where there's lots of layoffs. Companies prey on that because they know people are desperate out here. So, of course, with AI, I know we see the open AIs and all of that, but everybody's not going to work at open AI. But you can still expect to see six-figure range roles when it comes to that, to AI roles.
And if you're like Kiera, your six figures start with a two.
Hey, man, I didn't say all that.
She didn't say it, but I had to say it for her. Yeah. But no, what's one thing that you wish we would have asked you that we didn't ask you?
Oh, what's one thing? Oh, we didn't get the chance to talk about the AI influencers.
Yes.
So that one.
What are your thoughts?
So that one's scary. And by AI influencers, what I mean, what we mean by that are the YN characters that are popping up, and then the ones that have like the vlogs going on, yeah, where they're doing their makeup or talking about their days. Basically, it's AI is mimicking humans and pretending like they're actually like influencers that you would see on Instagram. Yeah. I am worried because the way those videos look and the audio looks, it's much more advanced than what it was years ago when you could tell that you something was AI because of the they were missing fingers or there was something going on when they blink. Now it looks like there's just an extra filter on them. There's two things. One, I'm worried the negative side of that is, of course, how it betrays our portrays our community. It doesn't look good. And it continues to create or instigate that stereotypes or the stereotypes that are placed upon us. I do think that there might be people of other cultures that are playing into this and also engagement farming. Like I've seen people argue or use incel-like YouTube AI influencers to like further their rhetoric. And I don't know if they understand that that's AI that they're watching and spewing information from, which is bad. And it shows, like I said, the level of critical thinking that's going on. But there's also some good from that for our community because we can use those to create faceless channels to bring and spread information that is positive. There's always a way that you can spin it to figure out how to make money and how to benefit from it without it being harmful.
Yeah.
Also, we already see this on Twitter when people be trying to engage with these rage bait type of things, knowing for a fact probably like an Indian person or somebody is behind it and they making money off all the stupid stuff when we engaging with it.
Exactly. And I think that it's a deterrent in a sense that it's really keeping people away from the things that they really need to be focused on. And now is not the time to be engaged in nonsense or things that are quick to spike your cortisol and all that stuff. Like it's just too stressful. You have other things to focus on, like paying bills. Like and don't get me wrong, seeing all the little hypotheticals and all that stuff is fun, after a while. But if you're spending your days in and out on that, it's too much. Like if you're waking up, the first thing you see on Twitter is something that's making you upset. That's not good. And it really will give you a good day of how your day is going to go. And if you continue that path of really how your life's going to go. But there's that one. Oh, another one AI agents.
Yeah.
The question was just about, one of the questions I think was like, of course, how I'm seeing it play out, especially in the corporate world and where it could go from there. I'm extremely bullish on AI agents. If you don't know what that is, it's basically, it's similar to Gen AI, but what it is something that can not only think and output information to you, but it also can take up and do tasks that you would normally do as a human, such as if you want to book a flight somewhere, there's an agent that could look like a chatbot and you'll say, hey, I want a trip to Taiwan. It'll go and find a flight for you, book that flight for you. And if you even want hotels or something like that or additional tickets, it will do all that for you versus going to just ChatGPT and saying, hey, what's the best places to go to Taiwan? It'll go the extra step of doing things for you. I think that they're interesting. I think they're great. I think that a lot of people are playing on the fact that many people don't know what AI agents are, and they're selling people automated script packages instead of actual AI agents. But that's a story for another day. And I'm really excited to see how it takes off. I am starting to see some complications in the enterprise just because there's a lot of proprietary information that's there. And again, AI agents, they're non-deterministic. That means that you never really know what input they're going to get or output they're going to give you. You can ask it, the same question 50 times and you'll get 50 different answers, and they might not be wrong. They'll just be slightly different, or it could be wrong, but extremely convincing. So that's something that companies need to think about, especially when it comes to compliance and any type of risk laws that are there. I do see one really cool use case from Cognizant, And it was, I heard about it on a podcast. Basically, they have an AI agent for every single department. So when someone needs to go talk to somebody else in a different department, they'll ask their own department's agent to go talk to that team's agent, and mm-hmm. that agent will That's get the information cool. for them.
Point of contact.
Yes. And I think it's really cool because a lot of departments are siloed. Very. And so it can be very hard to talk to people, especially if they're out of town or something. So those agents make a way for those people to communicate easier. A really cool use case that they also gave was their son had just turned 26. So they talked to the HR agent, or their agent talked to the HR agent and said, hey, so-and-so's son turned 26. And that's all they said. And the agent was like, oh, congratulations. Would you like some time off to celebrate? Which was cool. And then also on top of that, it was like, by the way, your son is 26. Here's what this would look like for your insurance plan, since they now have to get their own insurance. Which is really cool, because how would you, unless you don't really know about that. So it pulled up the company's policies. For enterprise, a lot of them are going to use RAG agents because they have their own internal documentation and stuff like that. So it's funny that RAG is dying because AI agents are here, but RAG is still very important in the enterprise. And then lastly, while I'm on my soapbox, I'm also really excited about agents, because I've been talking about something called Agent Ops, and it's basically DevOps for AI agents. And I've been talking about it and speaking about it at conferences, and I'll be doing it through the rest of this year. And what Agent Ops does is just make sure that you're building trustworthy, scalable, reliable agents. A lot of companies are just coding these agents and shipping them. And there's a lots of failures in a sense of, as we saw with, what's his name, Claudius or somebody? Claudius, how he was talking back to people when they told him he wasn't real, or he was giving them the wrong information about prices. There's got to be some checks and monitoring and balances for that, just like we do with regular software. We check and make sure code's not breaking. We have to make sure the agent isn't breaking. We also have to check and make sure compliance and risk is there. Are we making sure, you know, what are the things that we need to focus on before we even code this agent? There's a lot more that goes into it than just coding something. And that requires a lot of stakeholders in place. So that requires legal, law. If it's a healthcare agent, you got to have in healthcare providers and all these people. So I'm really excited to talk about this because I don't see really many people talking about it. And it also gives me a chance to bring in DevOps and SRE work and also my strategy knowledge to talk about AI. And also, there's a data component too. A lot of people think that AI just runs on its own. Like I said, it needs data. Data has to be there in order for AI to exist. Otherwise, what would it use to make predictions? So, yeah, that was very long-winded, but yeah.
No, you're good. Just when you get to your leadership position and doing that, just hire me to come protect it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Where can the listeners and the viewers, how can they keep up with you?
Oh, many different places. So on Twitter, my handle is IamKierraD. If you search the Data Conversationalist, I'll pop up anyways. I'm also on Instagram and TikTok as well. You can find me on there. If you need any type of career coaching, I've talked to people who were literally just like working in fast food all the way to directors of data. So if you are interested in any of the data roles, I can help with that, as well as DevOps and SRE work. I also have a Substack called the Data Digest, where I talk about and provide actionable tips for people in tech. Of course, it's more skewed to data people, but it's still the same information applies to all people in tech. I also have my own thedataconversationalist.com website, and that's where you can find a lot of my takeaways from me doing research and my findings, as well as contacting me for any type of speaking opportunities that you might want to present to me.
Perfect, guys. And that's been another episode of Textual Talk. And as I always say, let's stay textual, and we out. Peace.